Today is Tuesday, December 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. U.S. health authorities cut in half the number of days people should isolate if they're COVID-19 positive. One U.S. governor says unvaccinated people are the reason for record hospitalizations.
If we are forced to move to a crisis standard of care in our hospitals, it will be because massive numbers of unvaccinated people chose to let others go without quality care.
Rights groups say several democracies were at risk in 2021.
Now, there is a general feeling in many democracies that citizens are unhappy with what the government's been doing for them, and they're willing to support candidates who offer to disrupt the system.
And indirect talks between Iran and the U.S. on Iran's nuclear program resumed on Monday. We'll have these stories and more next. American health authorities have shortened the recommended time people should isolate when they've tested positive or have been exposed to COVID if they are asymptomatic. Now the CDC says people only have to isolate for 5 days instead of 10 if they test positive but don't have symptoms and continue to wear a mask around others for another 5 days. People who were sick but whose symptoms are improving and don't have a fever can also leave home after 5 days. The same goes for people who were exposed to COVID but are fully vaccinated. The CDC says the change is based on scientific evidence that most transmission occurs early in the disease, right before and after the onset of symptoms. Airline and other industry executives have been asking the CDC to shorten recommended quarantine and isolation, saying the rash of canceled flights over the past few days were largely driven by employees who tested positive for the virus and were isolating for 10 days. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker warns the Omicron variant is spreading and thousands of people are filling hospital beds because many still refuse to get vaccinated.
If we are forced to move to a crisis standard of care in our hospitals, it will be because massive numbers of unvaccinated people chose to let others go without quality care. And even more people will die.
U.S. President Joe Biden said this week that the U.S. was making progress against COVID, but cases are rising again due to the unvaccinated.
America had made progress. Things are better. But we do know that with the rising cases, we still have tens of millions of unvaccinated people, and we're seeing hospitalizations rise.
The United States has recorded the most COVID deaths with more than 818,000, followed by Brazil with nearly 619,000 and India with 480,000 as of Tuesday. The top U.S. infectious disease expert says the U.S. should consider a vaccination mandate for domestic air travel. Dr. Anthony Fauci says such a mandate might drive up the lagging U.S. vaccination rate and provide stronger protection on flights as infection rates spike. The Biden administration has so far avoided imposing a vaccination requirement for domestic air travel. If excess mortality linked to COVID-19 is taken into account, the World Health Organization estimates that the overall death toll could be 2 to 3 times higher. The president of Somalia has suspended the country's prime minister over alleged corruption in the latest fight over who will lead the country and the nation's delayed elections. Critics of President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, also known as Farmajo, says he's looking to stay in power. As Mohamed Kahiye reports from Mogadishu, Somalia, the two men recently disagreed on the electoral process.
In a press briefing, embattled Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble said he will carry on his constitutional mandate to conduct the electoral process for a peaceful transfer of power. The Prime Minister termed the move by the head of state to relieve him of his duties as an attempted coup. He said the decision by the former President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed Farmajo are a clear attempted coup, violation of the constitution and the laws of the country. The Prime Minister added that, apart from the violation of the country's law, President Farmajo used security agencies to attack the office of the Prime Minister and that of the Cabinet to try and halt their national duties. The residents of the capital, like Abdulwahid Hussein, say they are concerned political upheaval could spark violence similar to clashes in April between forces allied to opposition and the government troops that rocked the capital, Mogadishu. He said the difference between the president and the prime minister is very unfortunate because it could lead to violence and create insecurity that will displace people and destroy investment. Omar Yusuf is a political analyst and a lecturer of international relations at the University of Simat. He says the country's leaders need to show restraint amid reports security forces have been deployed around Robles offices. When the disagreements translate to violence and use of armed forces, it will be a difficult environment to conduct elections, and thus the process could stall again. And once the elections are over, it will pose a significant threat to state-building process in Somalia, which has been recovering for the past two decades. He added that, in order to avoid that destruction, both sides must refrain from using security agencies and still start dialogue in holding transparent elections. The U.S. Embassy in Mogadishu strongly urged Somali leaders to take immediate steps to de-escalate the tensions and refrain from proactive actions. Somalia's parliamentary elections were supposed to conclude before end of the year, but are nowhere near complete, with over just 70 members of parliament out of 329 selected so far by the tribal delegates. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
Western powers urged Libya to quickly reschedule the delayed presidential elections that were scheduled to take place on December 24th. Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and the U.S. said they would continue to recognize Libya's interim government after its presidential election was delayed, but called for the new election date to be set as soon as possible. Reporter Angie Omar spoke to Jason Pack, head of the Libya Analysis Group and author of Libya and the Global Enduring Disorder, on the developments of Libya's elections.
In an ideal world, yes, of course, in an ideal world, the international community, if it's unified, would be able to structure these Libyan elections. But we don't live in an ideal world. And in fact, the Western powers have no leverage. You have to keep in mind that the very nature of the UN process entailed that if December 24th, 2021 came and went with no elections, that the current interim GNU government would no longer be legitimate and not stay in power. But of course, the international community has no power to enforce that, and it's not willing to deny sovereignty to this government. So similarly, calling for it to help make there be new elections, or calling on the HOR or HNEC, the Electoral Commission, to make the elections, doesn't expedite the process. The West and the UN have lost control completely. So they're just hoping that the different Libyan factions can pull things together.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres reiterate that the UN continues to support the holding of presidential and parliamentary Libyan elections as soon as possible. The special advisor to the Secretary General in Libya, Ms. Stephanie Williams, and the United Nations support mission in Libya will continue to support a Libyan-led and Libyan-owned process to address outstanding challenges and ensure the holding of presidential and parliamentary elections as soon as possible. What role do you think Stephanie Williams can play to achieve this goal?
Well, only Stephanie Williams can make the election happen. She argues that it's a Libyan-led process. The Libyans, via the LPDF, chose the December 24th date, and that Libyans can solve their way out of this conundrum. That's very noble of her. I see it differently. I see that Stephanie came up with the concept of the elections. She came with the way of tying the ceasefire to the elections. And only Stephanie can now fix what Jan Kubisch, her successor and now predecessor, has caused as a crisis. So only Stephanie can come up with the ways to cajole the various Libyan factions who don't want to have the elections to seeing that they'll be in a worse position by not having the elections. So in Stephanie, we trust.
The Electoral Commission proposed pushing back the voting date by a month amid disputes over the rules, including the eligibility of several divisive candidates. Saif al-Islam Gaddafi and Eastern Military Chief Khalifa Haftar were both in the running despite accusations of war crimes. How could these disputes be handled?
Well, it is quite clear that Saif al-Islam and Haftar being allowed to run is one of the main reasons that the elections were delayed. It caused attacks on polling stations in the West, and it has created the complexity of, is it the judiciary or HNEC who can vet the candidates? I mean, I see these things as really cut and dry. If we look at Law 20, Haftar shouldn't be allowed to run because he has a U.S. citizenship and no dual nationals are allowed to run. Saif al-Islam shouldn't be allowed to run because it says no one with outstanding legal cases, either internationally or in Libya, should be allowed to run. So I don't understand why the legal authorities did not very quickly disqualify them. They need to be disqualified vis-a-vis Libyan law, and then we can move forward with these elections.
That was reporter Angie Omar speaking with Jason Pack, president of Libya Analysis. Indirect talks between Iran and the United States on salvaging the 2015 Iran nuclear deal resumed on Monday, with Tehran focused on one side of the original bargain, lifting sanctions against it, despite scant progress on reining in its nuclear activities. Reuters reporter Gloria So has the story.
An eighth round of talks aimed at salvaging the Iran nuclear deal kicked off in Vienna on Monday. Tehran has maintained its focus on one side of the original 2015 bargain, demanding sanctions against it be lifted. They've also refused to meet directly with U.S. officials, forcing the deal's remaining parties to shuttle between the two sides. Little remains of the original deal. It had lifted sanctions on Iran in exchange for restrictions on its nuclear activity. Then U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out of the deal in 2018 and reimposed sanctions. That prompted Tehran to breach and even exceed many of those nuclear restrictions. The previous round of talks ended a little over a week ago after adding some new Iranian demands, with Western powers warning that time was running out for negotiations. Iran insists all U.S. sanctions must be lifted before steps are taken on the nuclear side, while Western negotiators say both demands must be balanced. U.S. sanctions have slashed Iran's oil exports, its main source of revenue. Tehran does not disclose data, but shipping assessments suggest a fall from around 2.8 million barrels per day in 2018 to a fraction of that volume, as low as 200,000.
That is Gloria So with Reuters. A Chinese newspaper is reporting this week that a group of U.S. officials have applied for visas as part of a delegation to China to provide security support during the 2022 Winter Olympic Games in Beijing. Earlier, the Biden administration announced that it would not send a high-level delegation to watch the games out of human rights concerns in China. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell tells me that the White House said it has not changed its position and will not send senior officials to be in the stands at the Beijing Games.
So the South China Morning Post, which is a well-respected newspaper based in Hong Kong, claims that 18 Americans have sought three-month visas during the Beijing Games and that they are applying for these visas as security support operations. I asked the White House about this, and they did not give us any details on the number of people, but they did confirm in a fashion that, yes, they are applying for visas for people. And I'm just going to read kind of what they told me. We intend to provide consular and diplomatic security services to ensure our athletes, coaches, trainers, and staff are secure and have access to the American citizen services that we provide to all American citizens overseas. So far we have about 200 athletes who've qualified for the games, which start February 4th. And these people who are coming, who are not high-level diplomats, are just going to ensure that they get the services they need. And so that is what they're doing there. They say that the diplomatic boycott continues.
So essentially, you're saying then that the Biden administration policy, its decision not to attend the games, hasn't changed.
Exactly. That is what the administration told me this morning, that they said that their position that they announced earlier this month remains our position and will not be changing. And that is their decision to boycott the games over ongoing genocide and crimes against humanity in Xinjiang and other human rights abuses.
And getting back to these 18 people that they were looking to get visas for, it sounds like they're saying we need to at least provide protective services for our people. There's going to be some 200 athletes and trainers and such over there. Is that more or less what's going on?
Right. This is to make sure that they understand, I guess, the laws and the social mores of the place that they're in and to protect them. As you may recall, in Brazil, I believe, in the Rio Games, a famous U.S. swimmer caused some trouble going out at night and causing a bit of a ruckus. And I'm sure that these consular and diplomatic security personnel are also there just to kind of assist these athletes who may be so focused on their performance in the games that they're not really thinking about how they also need to perform on the world stage when they're in a foreign country.
That is VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell. She was speaking with me Monday in Washington. You're listening to VOA News.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll explore the history and experiences of the African diaspora and how their connection to the continent has changed over generations. We'll also profile young Americans of African descent making their mark in U.S. politics. Join me, Haydee Adams, for the next Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Carol Van Dam. Russia's Supreme Court on Tuesday ruled that one of the country's oldest and most prominent human rights organizations should be shut down, a decision that prompted public outrage. It's the latest step in a months-long crackdown on rights activists, independent media outlets, and opposition supporters. The Prosecutor General's office last month petitioned the Supreme Court to revoke the legal status of Memorial, an international human rights group that rose to prominence for its studies of political repression in the Soviet Union. The umbrella group encompasses more than 50 smaller organizations in Russia and abroad. Turkish and Qatari companies have agreed to jointly operate 5 airports in Afghanistan, but they are still waiting to reach a final agreement with the Taliban leadership. Turkey's foreign minister said on Monday that a memorandum of understanding had been signed in Doha earlier this month, which covers Kabul and 4 other airports. In Argentina, evangelical pastors have become more and more influential inside prisons, especially in Santa Fe province. Officials there say about 40% of inmates live in cell blocks run on evangelical rules. Those units are similar to those in the rest of the prison, but officials say they are safer and calmer. A shooting spree in and around the western U.S. city of Denver, Colorado, has left 5 people dead, including the gunman, and left an officer wounded. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
The rampage happened Monday. Police say it began in Denver, where the gunman killed 3 and wounded 1 before he went to the suburb of Lakewood, where he killed another person and wounded 2 others, including an officer. Denver Police Department Chief Paul Pazin.
We believe that this individual was responsible for this very violent series of events that took place in the Denver metro area.
Pazin says they're investigating a motive. Lakewood Police Department spokesman John Romero says having one of their own shot is hard to handle.
It's a tough day for the Lakewood police family, obviously, when this happens to one of our own.
I'm Julie Walker.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
The ongoing multi-nation robotic exploration of Mars continues to unlock secrets of the planet's past. Both orbiting and rover investigations have provided evidence that water, one of the key ingredients for life as we know it, once existed and still is present on the red planet. The joint European Space Agency Roscosmos ExoMars Trace Gas Orbiter has recently found proof of substantial amounts of water just beneath the surface of the planet in the middle of Valles Marineris, a vast canyon system that scientists say is the largest in the solar system. The space agencies say in a press release that the water could be in the form of ice or liquid, that it's chemically attached to other minerals in the soil. The water was found with the orbiter's fine resolution epithermal neutron detector or FRIEND neutron telescope. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The coronavirus has touched some members of a superstar K-pop group. AP Entertainment correspondent Oscar Wells Gabriel has that story.
Three members of BTS have now tested positive for COVID-19. The K-pop group's management agency says RM and Jin were diagnosed on Saturday evening. A third member, Suga, tested positive on Friday. The group had just returned from a series of performances away from South Korea, and their management says all three who have now tested positive had their second dose of vaccinations in August. Only one of the three, Jin, has any symptoms, and his are said to be mild. He and the other two are reported undergoing self-care at home in harmony with guidelines set out by South Korean health officials. I'm Oscar Wells Gabriel.
In some of the coups seen on the African continent, a common factor has been violent Islamist militants. The number of militant attacks increased this past year in the Sahel region, leading to political instability that saw a coup in Mali, an attempted coup in Niger, and calls for Burkina Faso's president to resign. Burkina Faso experienced the deadliest terrorist attack since the conflict began, but analysts say the worst could be yet to come. Henry Wilkins reports from Burkina Faso.
2021 marks the ninth year of conflict in Africa's Western Sahel, and in Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger, violence has only worsened. A video recently posted online purports to show an attack on a military base in northern Burkina Faso that killed almost 50 military police in November. Terrorists said to be linked to Al-Qaeda can be seen firing heavy weapons from the backs of pickup trucks before burning and looting the base. Across Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger, fatalities from clashes between state forces and armed groups linked to Islamic State, Al-Qaeda and criminal gangs are up 18% since last year, according to data from the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project. The humanitarian impact has been huge, with close to 3.4 million people now displaced as a result of the conflict, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency. Amadou Agli from Burkina Faso fled the north of the country about 3 months ago after terrorists attacked nearby villages. He says he has a message for the world. He says his community is living through very hard times and appeals to any people, NGOs and governments around the world who can help them. He says they're suffering, a food crisis, a housing crisis, and that the children are unable to attend school. The year also saw a shift in the region's military structure, says Paul Melly, an analyst with London-based Chatham House, a research institution.
Start the process of moving towards a new pattern of French deployment where the Sahel armies in the G5 Sahel military structure are much more the frontline face, if you like, with the French in a more of a backup and special forces role, air support, intelligence.
France, which had 5,000 troops supporting Sahel security forces at the beginning of 2021, has said it will reduce that number to 3,000 by early 2022. Escalating insecurity has also plunged Sahel government into political turmoil. Mali saw a coup by military leader Assimi Goïta in May after street protests against insecurity. The West African political bloc ECOWAS, along with France, have put pressure on Goïta to hold democratic elections in 2022. Protests against the government's handling of security in Burkina Faso in November forced the government to reshuffle military leadership and the cabinet. Andrew Leibovich is an analyst with the European Council on Foreign Relations.
What people are concerned about is the ongoing insecurity and the state of the security forces. So if that doesn't improve, then no, the change in government certainly will not be enough to appease the opposition.
Leibovich says analysts are also keeping an eye on attacks in Burkina Faso's border area with coastal West Africa states, including Benin and Ivory Coast.
So I do think at a minimum it's something to really be concerned about, something to watch out for and something to actively work against.
Meanwhile, in Niger, the emergence of civilian militia groups to fill the security gap could play a big role in 2022. In other Sahel countries, they have been used to assist the military, but have also been accused of human rights abuses, says Philippe M. Fraud, an associate professor at the University of Ottawa.
We've seen this in southwestern Niger recently, kind of community violence, which is spiraling and driven a lot by non-state armed groups. We see this in Burkina Faso as well, where we have the state, in fact, relying on groups like this.
After a difficult 2021, the Sahel conflict look set to worsen as the new year begins. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of Nadia Taha and the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington.